This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the last programme in the current series of Passing the Picket.
All commentators now describe it as probably the biggest dispute in the history of the state, certainly since 1913.
On this week's programme, I'm looking back into the recent past at a dispute which brought more than 100,000 Irish workers out onto the streets in protest.
Both sides in the dispute at Irish Ferries have been at the Labour Relations Commission again this afternoon.
The core issue in this dispute is the future employment of Irish seafarers on the Irish Sea routes.
There's power in a factory. Power in the land, power in the hand of the worker.
When Irish Ferries first decided to outsource work on board one of their ships to migrant workers in 2004, the company met with enormous resistance from SIPTU, who at the time represented most of the company's officers and some of their ratings. This dispute escalated to the extent that in the run-up to Christmas 2005, three of the company's ships were tied up at sea, while an arduous round of talks between a number of third parties and unions and management at the company sought to reach an agreement. Although nobody from Irish Ferries is participating in tonight's programme, they did give me a briefing on their perspective on the industrial relations dispute in question. In terms of the background of the company, Irish Ferries was formed in 1991 when Irish Continental Line bought over the state-owned B&I Line. At the time, it was estimated that the company had in the region of £38 million written off by the state. Between 1992 and 2001, Irish Ferries invested more than £400 million in the company. They bought four new ships, including the Ulysses car ferry in 2001, which at the time was the biggest car ferry in the world. But as RTE's industrial relations correspondent Ingrid Miley explains, shortly afterwards, the company began to experience financial difficulties.
Around 2001, the economic climate started to change. You had Ryanair, for example, coming in. The low-cost airlines were starting to have a big impact on the traditional foot passenger traffic that would have been using ferries traditionally. Also, it became a more competitive environment with other operators, and that was to set the scene for the need to cost cut very dramatically in order to make the company viable, as Irish Ferries would have seen it.
Well, I think there was clear acceptance from us that there had to be changes, because the benchmarking analysis clearly said that Irish Ferries, the company, was out of sync with its main competitors.
That's SIPTU official Paul Smith. He's a former officer with Irish Ferries and was one of the key negotiators involved in the Irish Ferries dispute.
I believe that it was right for the unions to go into a restructuring programme to try and see if we could reduce the costs on the basis of making the company more competitive. We went into a process which delivered that change. Now, that was just for the UK routes. We concluded the agreement, I think, around June, July. And it was hard for me to sell it to the membership, because it was a lot of pain, but we did. But it was good. It was a good agreement. And I think, you know, Alf McGrath, the HR guy, would acknowledge that it was a good agreement and the relationship was fairly good.
So far, so good. Irish Ferries had sought to get savings of 5.5 million, but ultimately achieved 3.2 million by changing some of the working arrangements on their UK routes. In 2004, however, they decided to focus on cutting costs on the MV Normandy, the ferry which serviced the French route. And this time, their cost-cutting proposals were far more radical.
They were up against Brittany Ferries, who in some senses were effectively subsidised by the French government. They felt that, you know, British Brittany Ferries could undercut them on that route, and they felt that their staffing and cost base on the Normandy was not acceptable anymore. So they sought cost cuts, significant cost cuts, and the unions resisted this. They tried to suggest their cost cuts. They couldn't reach agreement. And eventually the company announced that they wanted to basically abolish all the jobs on the Normandy. That would have been about 150 jobs, make those workers redundant and replace them with outsourced crews from third-party contracting agencies. This was anathema to the unions. If there is one core value that the unions have resisted in Ireland in all of the changing economic circumstances of recent years, it has been outsourcing. They see this as a recipe for lower terms and conditions, less protections for workers, and a lessened relationship between the worker and the de facto employer where they happen to be working.
They met with me just the day before, or the day of, the announcement to all of the staff. And they announced to me that what their intention was to outsource all of the functions on board the ship to a charter company, and they were going to make redundant all of the people on board. Now, understand, SIP2 only represented the officers on that particular ship. We had officers and ratings in all of the other ships. So numerically, the numbers for us, it wasn't a big issue. But the principle was huge, because I was saying, now the company indicated to us that this arrangement would only be confined to the Normandy, that they were quite happy with the agreement. Now, and the chief executive, Eamon Rothwell, went on record publicly to say that. But I was of the view, and I couldn't reconcile this in my head, that if you were to outsource to a management company where you were going to apply draconian, you know, rates below the minimum wage in terms and conditions, how could you rationalise to your board that you shouldn't do that to your other ships? So I told the company very, very clearly that I would oppose it, right, and that I saw it as a fundamental breach in principle. And that's where the, you know, we started off in a dispute about the Normandy. I didn't believe that the company's intention was really to go that route, but I thought what it was probably trying to do was to force the unions into a negotiating position on the Normandy, because the one thing that the company weren't happy with was the degree of savings that we gave on the Normandy. And if that's what their goal was, well then I had no difficulty with that, because I believed that the union should have done a deal on the Normandy, a more comprehensive deal, during those talks. That was always my view, and I said it to the union, the other union that was involved. I said that I felt that they were making a mistake and that we should do it, right? So, you know, I was of the view this is a tactic that the company are employing to force a negotiation. I didn't genuinely believe that the company were going to do what they did.
What made the Irish Ferries situation unique in terms of employment legislation was the fact that their employees are not officially employed on Irish soil, which is where the whole issue of the Irish flag versus the flag of convenience comes into play. Ingrid Miley explains.
Irish employment law protections apply on Irish soil, but they do not apply on a ferry unless, if that ferry is registered in another country. So that is why where the boats were, the ships were registered was crucial in this dispute. Many, many ferries and ships worldwide register in places like Liberia, in the Bahamas, in Nassau, in all these places, because there are lower terms and conditions and lower levels of employment rights protection for workers applying there. And so it was crucial where Irish ferries were going to flag these vessels. Because the workers were not on dry land, these migrant workers who were going to come in, once it was decided that the ships would be flagged abroad, those workers would not enjoy the protections of the Irish worker here on dry land. And I think it's important to stress one other thing. Irish ferries were legally entitled to do what they were doing. They didn't break any laws. And that is what made it so difficult for the government. The government couldn't actually force Irish Ferries to do anything other than what it was doing.
You'll have heard Paul Smith refer to the other union which was involved in negotiations with Irish Ferries. That other union was the Seamen's Union of Ireland, and Anthony Couser is its Assistant General Secretary. He worked for Irish Ferries, primarily on the MV Normandy, for 32 years.
I walked on the Continental route, which was always governed by the fact that we made our money in the summer. It was a summer run. And in the winter then we toddled along just to get by. But the money was made in the summer to keep it going all year round. There was always stories that this wasn't right and that wasn't right. And we always put it down that the company just weren't happy. They weren't making enough money for the shareholders. So when it eventually happened that Eamon Rothwell and the rest of the management team came down and told us that the writing was on the wall, everything was finished, we were all taken by surprise.
Tensions arose early on in that dispute between the two unions, largely because the majority of SUI members jumped at the offer of a redundancy package above the alternative, which was redeployment on the Irish Sea. Although many SIP2 members did opt for redundancy, the union leadership were opposed to the package on offer. Anthony Couser explains why so many SUI members wanted out.
There was never much positive coming out of the company. You know, everything was all bad news. And I think at the end of the day, they'd been used to working a certain way on the Continental route, and when the alternative offered to them was the short sea route, they just said, look, we don't want to work for this company anymore. They didn't like the company, didn't like the way it was being run. So they left. They just ran off the ship, in fact. As soon as the carrot was dangled, people were gone.
And was that very frustrating for you? Like, were you trying to rally the troops all the time?
Well, we did try, but we just hadn't got the support there at the end of the day. And I think the company all along were well aware of this, you know what I mean? They knew by the amount of applications that they'd had. They'd received phone calls of people saying, look, I don't mind that union, I want this, I want that, you know, I'm out of here.
there were a huge amount of people that wanted to go, that actually were sitting there, give us the money, you know, we want to go. And the Seamen's Union of Ireland quite clearly took a position where they weren't really opposed to it at all. I mean, why, I don't know, but they weren't really opposed to it. But SIP2 did nail its colours to the mast, yeah, immediately, and said, we're opposed to it. We're opposed to this because we believe it's going to lead to what eventually it led to. And we believe that the future of the Irish marine industry is now going to be totally wiped off the planet.
Well, I suppose SIP2 did their own thing and they looked after themselves, and you can't blame them for that either, you know. But with regard to the meetings up in the LRC, we were more or less on the periphery of all those negotiations. We were asked at the start, would we sit aside and let them settle the dispute? It was deemed at the time that the dispute was between SIP2 and the company, even though we were the biggest union in the company at the time. So we did that, and as I say, we were on the periphery of the thing. And well, when we saw what would come out of it at the end of the day, you know, about the flag and stuff like that, we were fairly upset with that. You know, we weren't happy with the fact we lost the flag, but we didn't really have a great say in it.
Irish Ferries decided to cut the 150 jobs on the Normandy to make those workers redundant and outsource. SIP2 in particular resisted that very, very strongly, and they called an all-out strike of their members from December the 6th of 2004. Eventually, a deal was done in the Labour Court. The proposal suggested that the officers, who would be a minority of the workers, and they're represented by SIP2, should be kept on as direct labour. That the ratings, represented by the Seamen's Union of Ireland, they would be the ordinary seamen, could be outsourced. The net effect of this was that around 90% of the workers took voluntary redundancy. The remainder were redeployed onto the three remaining ships on the Irish Sea route, and that staved off the trouble in the short term.
After the dispute on board the MV Normandy was settled and Irish Ferries management implemented their outsourcing model, there followed a series of talks which involved the Labour Relations Commission and the Labour Court. The situation soon reached a head, however, when talks broke down between both sides and SIP2 issued strike notice.
We had served notice on the company because the company were not prepared to discuss with us all of the issues. We had served notice. The notice wasn't due to take effect until the next Friday, and the company decided in advance of the dispute to try and stop all of the ships, ordered all the passengers off. The ships arrived into Holyhead and Pembroke. The Jonathan Swift arrived in here, and the passengers, the superintendents came on board and instructed all of the shore people to lift the ramp. These were ordinary day trippers who had gone off, you know, to get some shopping ashore, who were coming back after doing their day trip. Company gave an instruction to lift the ramps and to close up, that they weren't taking any more passengers back. They asked the captain, instructed the captain to sail to a port unknown. So at that stage, this was on a Sunday, I'll always remember it, and I got phone calls, and I told them, number one, they can't tell a captain to sail to a port unknown because it's in breach of safety requirements, so the captain shouldn't go. It was clearly in breach of every agreement that we had with them, that if they were going to send us to a different port or stop the route, they had to talk to us. They didn't. So the ship stopped. But the big thing that forced the company into actually dealing with that issue was the captain on board the Jonathan Swift had passengers on board, and that was due to berth in Holyhead, and he wouldn't take the ship in until he knew that he was going to be allowed dock and that the ship was sailing. But that's what caused the dispute, so the ship stayed there till we got a settlement just before Christmas.
Within 9 months, by September of 2005, the company announced not only was it going to seek some redundancies on its three Irish sea routes, it was going to seek to make all the workers redundant, all the seafarers. That was 550 jobs, and this was like a bolt from the blue. I think it is not surprising that Irish Ferries went on to seek these cost cuts. A lot of people said at the time that they were very surprised, but I have always felt that you have to remember that the Board of Irish Ferries had a fiduciary duty to the company, and they have a duty to their shareholders. And if they could get cost cuts and ergo profits from cutting jobs on the Normandy, it was only a matter of time before they would seek to do so on the Irish sea routes, because if they didn't, arguably, they could be in breach of their fiduciary duty to the company and to their shareholders. So I think that, it was not maybe as surprising as some people have suggested. But I think the reason it became such a big political issue was that the timing was not great from the point of view of the government. The next round of social partnership talks for a new national agreement were due to get underway in around September, October. But that is precisely the time that the Irish Ferries mass redundancy was announced. And For SIP2, this very rapidly became a watershed dispute. They realised that this was something they had to win. They realised that if Irish Ferries could, at a stroke, make 550 workers redundant and replace them with lower paid workers doing exactly the same work with no union representation and with no employment law protections, that would be a massively negative precedent for the future. It was also a major blow for the government because the government was trying to get the next round of partnership talks going. Once the Irish Ferries decision was announced, SIP2, as the largest union in the country, took a very important decision. At a conference in Cork, they decided that they would not go into partnership talks until the Irish Ferries issue was resolved. And that put the partnership process, it delayed it for a good 6 months. And that created economic uncertainty for the government. So it became a massive obstacle for the government in getting those talks going. There is another issue that must be mentioned in that context, and that is Irish Ferries was not the only case involving potential exploitation of migrant workers. In the same year, we had had the Gama dispute, which had highlighted Turkish workers coming over here working for Gama and serious questions being raised about the terms and conditions that were being applied to them. That dispute had highlighted shortcomings in the Labour Inspectorate. It had highlighted shortcomings in enforcement of employment protection. And so those two disputes going onto the agenda for the partnership talks were to create a completely different environment and agenda for what was to come in the next social partnership agreement.
Our union took the view that there could be no question, and I was party to when that decision was made, there could be no question of having discussions on the employer side and, you know, with the government and so on while that was going on. There's no question of it.
Patricia King is Regional Secretary of SIP2. She outlines how the dispute at Irish Ferries soon became a political issue.
When you're down to that level of fundamental displacement, exploitation, and it's so in your face, and it was, how could you reconcile that and be in talking under this dreaded word partnership? You couldn't possibly reconcile the two. There's no question of it. I mean, on the national pay talks were never going to happen while that Irish Ferries dispute was ongoing. No question of it.
Meanwhile, in terms of the strike itself, the major flashpoint happened when Irish Ferries brought security staff on board their ships along with some of their new crew members. Irish Ferries claimed that they took this measure to ensure that there wasn't a repeat of the episode on board their vessels the previous year. Paul Smith recalls how he first got wind of the fact that this was going to happen.
I remember I got an anonymous phone call on the Monday from a Dublin accent fella saying, listen, I work for a security company and I've been told Irish Ferries have hired us. There's 40 of us. I'm just ringing you to let you know. They just want a load of heavies, etc. So I didn't know whether or not. I asked the man for his name and he wouldn't give me his name, but he said he'd ring back and tell me if it was a go. So I didn't know whether that was true or false. I got another phone call either that evening or the following day, again from a different source saying the same thing. And I alerted people to the fact that there's all sorts of rumours abounding. So lo and behold, I couldn't believe it when I got a phone call at the early hours of the morning from Pembroke to say people had travelled over as passengers. And when the ship docked, they went into the toilets and took off their ordinary civilian clothes and got dressed up in the security attire. And people were seen doing this. And what happened was the minute they were sighted on the closed circuit TV from the engine room, they battened down in the engine room, secure the engine room. And that's where the story started, right? They secured the engine room on the Isle of Inishmore, battened down and wouldn't allow the security or anybody else into the engine room. And the dispute began then. A similar thing happened on the Ulysses, but the Ulysses didn't secure the engine room. But when they heard what was happening, the crew all met and decided that they also weren't moving. And I think people were appalled at, you know, even the people who wanted the redundancy, you know, people who were probably friendly towards the company because they, you know, because they wanted to get out of it, they became incensed over this. The public were incensed. I mean, the Dáil held an emergency debate where the only issue was Irish Ferries.
Basically, the Labour Relations Commission came into this and tried to negotiate. They faced a very difficult challenge. Their chief executive, Kieran Mulvey, and their director of conciliation, Kevin Foley, took personal charge of the talks. But Irish Ferries were absolutely adamant that they were going to go ahead with this. They said they had no alternative. It was a commercial imperative. The unions, by this stage, had a massive ideological situation, as well as the practical situation of protecting their workers who were going to be made redundant. So the atmosphere at the talks was very difficult, particularly since you had this siege going on the three ships, people locked into the engine rooms and communicating by mobile phone, new workers coming onto the ships at the behest of the company, allegedly on familiarisation, but clearly staking a claim to a certain extent to their new jobs coming on. And it was an extremely difficult atmosphere in which that last night of talks took place.
For the last 3 weeks of it, I don't think there was any exit out of discussions before probably 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. It was hugely stressful on everybody. It was hours and hours. You know, you were talking very little sleep at the end over a fairly long period of time. Very intensive stuff took over everybody's life. All the people involved, the people in, you know, in the third party institutions and all, they were all, strongly fatigued at the end of all of this. But nobody thought about that, because we were in a battle, and it was a battle that had to be won. And it was keep it focused, put the energy in, put the resource in, and get the thing done. Because we operate in a voluntary system in industrial relations in this country, this went way past the system. The system couldn't deal with the dispute. And so therefore, the dispute had to happen in a way that the employer was stopped. And nobody was going to have a ruling. Because it was on sea, the legislation didn't cover it. So you had difficulties there. I mean, we went to ministers, we went into departments, we went everywhere. But effectively, when you made an analysis of where you were at, there was nothing that was going to solve this, but that you changed the employer's view by doing what those men did. And what this employer was trying to do in bring in and displace the current workforce and bring in labour at the cheapest possible price, which was so abhorrent that every time you questioned what you were doing, your answer came very quickly. How can you let them do this? I still to this day wonder how the employer in that case can grapple with their own conscience as to how they did what they were attempting to do, how they dreamt it up, how they could even remotely think that this was an okay thing to do. To this day, I can't reconcile that, because I just couldn't go to that place. It's so apparent.
The memory that most people will probably always retain from the Irish Ferries dispute is the protest march that took place at its height on the 9th of December 2005.
There was a key thing about that march where there was 100,000 people, particularly the Dublin march. I'd been on many, many marches for many, many different, over many, many different issues. But the one key thing about that march, don't mind the 100,000 people that participated in the march, but all of the people who stood along the side all clapped and cheered. There was a sort of a feeling, I think, in Ireland at that stage that this particular issue generated such an amount of feeling that this was wrong and this had to be rectified. It also allowed Jack O'Connor in the discussions with the new agreement to clearly set down, you know, that there had to be protections, there had to be legislation, and there had to be a raft of agreements for the protection of labour.
I think it was fantastic to see people from not just different workers, but from different parts of the country coming up to support the workers in Irish Ferries. But I know from the union's point of view, it was a little bit embarrassing, because our own members didn't want to know. Our own members just wanted to get out. The vast, vast majority, now some of them obviously wanted to stay and fight for their jobs, but they were so few and far between that it just didn't bear mentioning. But here was all these people supporting the workers in Irish Ferries, and the workers in Irish Ferries couldn't have cared less. They just wanted to get out of away from Irish Ferries as quickly as possible.
So ultimately, at the end of the strike, the talks and the march, what exactly was the outcome? Ingrid Miley.
The outcome was a deal whereby, effectively, Irish Ferries got their outsourcing. It was decided that 48 jobs would be retained for Irish workers who did not want to take voluntary redundancy. And they were what they call red-circled, in that they were allowed to retain their existing terms and conditions. So they weren't put on Eastern European wages, let's just say. The company had originally planned to pay well below the Irish minimum wage to the new workers that it would be recruiting on an outsourced basis. It was agreed that they wouldn't be paid below the Irish minimum wage. The severance deal was 8 weeks pay per year of service, but 2 weeks of that was for cooperating with the people who were going to take your job. So you had to train in the people who were going to take your job. But in the end of the day, there was also a 3-year no strike clause. And Irish Ferries agreed to allow SIPTU to be introduced to the new crewing agencies, and but they had no obligation to force union recognition. So those were the key points. And the result of that was that the company were to get cost savings of around 11.5 million euro a year. But it wasn't over yet. While the Irish Ferries deal per se may have been resolved, the unions were determined to get mechanisms in place to ensure that this couldn't happen again. So what they did was they insisted and pushed very, very hard for a whole new regime of legislative change to ensure that mass redundancies of this kind could not happen again. They pushed for a major boosting of the employment rights protections agenda. They've pushed for a new National Employment Rights Authority, which has just been set up under Ger Deering, the former taxi regulator. The number of labour inspectors is going to be boosted from 30 to 90. But most critically, there is new legislation in place which will make it far more difficult for employers to engage in this kind of mass redundancy and replacement. So I think that while Irish Ferries may have achieved what they sought for themselves, what the dispute has created is a far more difficult situation for other employers. Because if anyone else tries to do this, there is now a far more restrictive and stringent employment rights and employment protections mechanism in place that will make it harder for this to happen again.
In fairness to those workers, they probably have done more for the betterment of our society than they'll ever imagine, because they made it that the Irish public, on that march on the 9th of December, the Irish public said, no, there is actually a line below which we won't go. When we got involved in talks at a national level, we were able to very legitimately bring to that table, deep into the establishment and deep into the system, that's how bad it is. Don't ask us to convince you anymore about how bad it is out there.
This dispute took on a life of its own, because if you think about it, the public generally, unless they're going to suffer personal disruption, generally they leave unions and management to fight out their rows, unless there's actually disruption to transport or something like that. They leave people to sort out their rows. But there was something about the Irish Ferries dispute that touched the public. And I think it was the idea that migrant workers from poorer countries than ours were going to replace Irish jobs, and that they were going to be paid less than half the minimum wage of this country. Now, bear in mind that the minimum wage is the threshold that we as a society set for poverty. It's the threshold that we set for what is a minimum acceptable earnings. And to pay someone half of that, I think that touched a nerve in the Irish psyche and made this such an important political row rather than just an industrial relations row.
That's all from me for this week, and indeed for the series. I hope you've enjoyed Passing the Picket over the past 8 weeks. My thanks to all who took part.
Passing the Picket was presented and produced by Fiona Kelly.